You, it is holiday season, isn't it? Coming up, it comes up quick. Good evening. We're going to start this evening, as we always do, with a consecration. And if you're new to that, it's simply a pause and a moment to just acknowledge where we are right now, to be present, and to offer our time together to the benefit of all beings. It's really our opportunity to just pause and remind ourselves that we want to be of service. So the things that we hear, may they be of service. The things that are said, may they be of service. And to move into that sort of space of open heart, away from the me and the I that we get caught up within during the day. So you can make an offering of our time together or of the entire day if this is heading towards your bedtime. So we just begin by closing the eyes so that we can begin to move within and just relaxing anything that seems to be a bit tense, maybe the shoulders. Maybe the thighs or the knees or the face. And then bringing your awareness to the flow of the breath in and out of the nostrils. Seeing if we can just keep the mind from wandering, focusing on the breath. Then we're going to follow that inhale up and over the skull, down, dropping down into the heart center. Maybe feeling the heart expanding or even just setting an intention to be in that place. And from here, we just make an internal offering of our time together. May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be at peace. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace. Okay, so this evening I thought we'd take a little bit of a diversion from what we have been studying with the Gita. We've sort of been picking these large themes and talking about them as they come up in the Bhagavad Gita. And then I thought tonight we would drill down a little further into something called the yamas and niyamas. These are mentioned in the Gita. They're also mentioned in many, many of the Hindu and yogic spiritual texts. But before I sort of go into that, I'll just kind of give you a rough idea of what they are. They are effectively similar to the Ten Commandments or the Buddhist precepts. I'm just going to run through them now so you really get a sense of what they are before I just talk about them in a bit more detail and why they're important and why tonight, of all nights, we're going to talk about them. And they are non-violence, non-lying, fullness, non-stealing, non-excess, non-grasping. Those are the yamas, they're called. And then the niyamas are contentment, purity, discipline, self-reflection, and surrender. So three of those are actually echoed in the Ten Commandments. I believe four in the Buddhist precepts and five are in Jainism. Agreement by many of the world's spiritual teachings that these are important guidelines to follow. As I say, they're mentioned in the Gita that we talked about in chapter 5 and 6, and then they're actually talked about as qualities of a devotee. They're mentioned, some of them. They're mentioned more in detail in the Yoga Sutras, which actually came after, or is thought to have come after the Bhagavad Gita. There's a bit more about them, and there are 10 in the Yoga Sutras. There are actually 20 in the Upanishads, which is a really, really ancient text, and I believe there are 12 in the Puranas. So, as yogis, modern yogis, we seem to have settled upon these 10 yamas and niyamas. There is a reason to their ordering. The yamas come before the niyamas. There are sort of eight steps, eight limbs of the yogic path, the final of the eight limbs sort of resulting in awakening of the heart. And the yamas and the niyamas make up the first two limbs. And they are in that order because if you sort of listen to the yamas, so non-violence, non-lying, non-stealing, non-excess, non-grasping, it is, they are guidances, they're actually restraints of that relate to us as we move around in the world in relation to others. Whereas the niyamas are more about moving inwards, contentment, purity, self-reflection, surrender. And of course, within Sanskrit, it's very, very thoughtful. And if they're laid out in an order, it's for a reason. And the reason is simply that we spend most of our time thinking about ourselves in relation to others and to the world. So really the yamas are what we would like to master or practice first. What I really love about the yamas is they're just one word. It's just one word. There's no you should do this, no you must do that. They're just one word. And because, again, they're Sanskrit, and I haven't studied Sanskrit formally, but I'm told that in Sanskrit you can sort of unpack one word and sort of really get down into it and have many, many different translations. So you can really kind of make them your own and get so much out of just this one beautiful word without feeling like a judgment upon you or any pressure to actually live by them. I like to think of them as commitments, like the Ten Commitments. So why in particular do we want to look at them this evening? Well, I was thinking, given what is happening in the world, particularly in the West right now, and even more particularly in the US, as a result of the election, that the yamas really can provide some guidance in these sort of trying times or worrying times. I know that I have turned to them for comfort in the 7 odd years that I've been getting to know them, and they've been very helpful to me. So I thought tonight in particular it'd be great to look at them. And I'm going to be honest with you, I thought we'd look at all five, and then as I began writing notes, I realized that, wow, even just one yama is so deep that we may only get to look at the very first one, which is the most important one because it comes first. So, and that's non-violence, and we're going to come onto that in a bit. So I just wanted to talk about, you know, where we are at the moment, and these are just sort of personal opinions. And that is, you know, my belief is that the majority of us share the same values, that, you know, we want to feed and support ourselves and our families, and we want a job and want to contribute to society, and we want affordable healthcare and accessible education and clean air and clean water and diversity and pay equity, and we want to feel safe. And those I truly believe that the majority of us want to feel. But the nature of politics is such that we have different ideas about how those values can become manifest. And that's just the nature of politics. So even if we share the same values, we sometimes, you know, have differing opinions about how we're going to get those values out into the world. And then what seems to be happening at the moment is that we have in the West, and don't forget it's been happening elsewhere for a very long time and even happening here, but more sort of quiet, that there's this minority of us that have been sort of given a voice, perhaps, that disagrees with some of those values that most of us hold dear. And it can be scary to hear that people don't have these values, especially as it's against what we want and our desires for the world. And it causes a lot of conflict and confusion. And some of, you know, I've been looking at spiritual advice for spiritual seekers over the past few days, just to see what they're saying. And it can be confusing, which is another reason I think I'm going to sort of talk about these yamas this evening, as I think they sort of quell some of the confusing words that we come across. So, for example, some of the advice I've seen, and all very, very good advice, I want to say, but nonetheless can be a bit confusing, is, you know, it's all an illusion anyway, so, you know, just be the witness, stand back and watch it, and don't let yourself get emotionally involved or entangled. Which is great, but then I heard the opposite opinion from Marianne Williamson, actually, was, well, aren't we here to transform the illusion? Which was a good point. Other advice is, you know, don't feed it, don't put your attention on what's going on, because where you put your attention, you sort of end up manifesting that outcome. But then again, you know, you could ask yourself, well, is that just putting my head in the sand? Is that negating the world and my humanity? Obviously, some people are offering that prayer is actually the best solution. But then confusingly, both the Dalai Lama and the Pope have said that prayer is not enough. they've been talking about climate change mainly with this sentiment. But both of them said that, you know, a lot of the problems we're facing are man-made problems, and therefore you can't go to God and ask him to solve it. Good points. Another piece of advice we're being offered is be positive, you know, that positive thoughts spread positivity. But some of the challenges of that is that, you know, are you just by putting a shine on everything, legitimizing some of these very strong and violent opinions that are cropping up? And then finally, we're being told not to judge. Trying not to judge others because they might have a difference of opinion to us, which is always good advice. There's nothing to say about that. It's always good advice, but it can be hard. It can be hard if you're clinging very much to your own opinion. It can be hard not to judge others, especially when you're scared about some of the outcomes. But one of the things that I was thinking about with all this sort of a little bit of confusing messaging coming from the spiritual community is that there's a place for everything, because as we practice and walk a spiritual path with the goal of diminishing the ego and sort of eliminating, you know, things like material desire and greed and sort of getting rid of those barriers to love, we're keeping our personality. That's never going to go. And each of us is so different that actually how we react and what we feel drawn to do when we are in a situation of conflict, not just now because of the environment we're in, but in general, it really will be dependent and unique to us. So, you know, perhaps if you're someone who releases judgment by going out and talking to people and understanding people, then the path for you right now is probably to go and be active and go and protest and meet people of differing views, or read more that may incite rage in you, but at least you'll begin to understand and then remove some of those blocks. Or maybe if your path is, if you're someone who wants to be out all the time, and then you sort of take a deep look within, and that's because, I don't know, maybe you just feel like you need to be out there being needed, or you're making an excuse, then maybe prayer and sitting down is the best thing that you could do right now. So like all of this advice, it's beautiful, and I think the you know, each in their own right is a spiritual path that could be taken right now. And the key really is just to go within and ask, like, find out what is the best path for you, and own that power, and find that, So all of these are sort of great advice, but something to really consider. And of course, when we feel conflict, it's a sure sign that there is spiritual work to be done. But what's great about the yamas and niyamas is that they offer so many different ways to do that work. So they offer within them a lot of different paths that can suit your personality and where you're feeling. You can really find something with them, and it's not just because there are 10. You know, as I mentioned, as you start to unpack them, even just one of the yamas and niyamas can offer so many different paths to take and so much inspiration. So we're going to be talking about the yamas today, and in particular the very first one, which is ahimsa. And I just want to, you know, point out that these restraints, and then the niyamas, which are called observances, they are not passive at all. It's very much about taking action and practice. So each one is about, you know, how can we apply this to our life? And perhaps, you know, how can we apply this to our current situation? So I'm going to talk about ahimsa, just generally what it is, and give them examples of people who've led a life of ahimsa. And then maybe within that, we'll talk about our current situation that we find ourselves in, if you're feeling in conflict or scared or confused at all. can be helpful, can be a source of comfort. So ahimsa literally translates as no harm. And it's also seen to be translated as non-violence. It's in the Buddhist precepts, and I'm pretty sure you can find a commandment that works with non-violence. So ahimsa, and as I mentioned, it is the first of the yamas, and that is no sort of coincidence. It's the first one because it's seen as the most important one. And of the yamas and niyamas, back in the old days, from what I've read, if you were an aspiring yogi, you had to master all the yamas and then all the niyamas before you could even go on to your yoga practice of, you know, posture and breathwork and meditation on your way to enlightenment and awakening. You had to master them all. And the very first one you had to master was ahimsa. But then at the same time, it said that you just take one of the yamas and niyamas, and if you pour your entire being into it, then actually you'll reach the end goal of an awakened heart. So sort of, yes, ahimsa is the most important one, but also if you just take one of the others, if they call out more to you and delve into it, you'll eventually get it to ahimsa anyway. So ahimsa, no harm, non-violence. And in its, you know, the most basic sense, ahimsa means no physical harm on people. That's kind of how we take it when we first hear ahimsa and we think about non-violence. Not kicking others or killing others. And for most of us, we go, well, okay, well, then I've got ahimsa nailed because I don't engage in those things. The beauty of the yamas, it really asks us to, it sort of requires us to keep asking the question, keep thinking about it. And so we start to think to ourselves, okay, and no physical harm on people. Why am I just thinking about physical harm on people? Automatically, it came to mind, oh, well, I don't kick humans, so that's fine. So hang on, what about animals? And it's asking us to take another look. It's not judging what we discover within that. We're just trying to explore ourselves and the way our mind works. So then we can start to think, okay, well, let's think about ahimsa with animals. And for yogis, it's very important to be a vegetarian or a vegan because of ahimsa. If you want to adhere to ahimsa, essentially you're agreeing to not harm animals in any way physically, you know, not supporting puppy mills, not wearing leather shoes, being mindful about all the things that you consume that wouldn't bring harm to animals. And then you can sort of take it another level with ahimsa, and then you think, okay, well, it's not just about humans, it's not just about animals, it's about the environment. So, you know, it makes you think more about, okay, well, if I'm going to practice ahimsa, then maybe I should start recycling or composting or lowering my carbon footprint, or maybe not taking as many baths, maybe not flying as many places. And it's not that you have to do these things. That's not what ahimsa is saying. It's just asking you to look at it and look at the excuses we give ourselves, and really just, you know, make us more mindful about living a life that is very sort of peaceful and doesn't bring harm to anyone or anything. And then there are sort of many indirect ways that ahimsa plays out. So, you know, maybe some of the companies that you buy from are supporting, I'm just trying to think, things like fracking or deforestation, or maybe they're paying for child labor. And in Buddhism, this is called right livelihood or right action, just really sort of being mindful about the things that you are doing as you're acting in the world. Are all of your actions non-violent? Which of your actions may actually bring harm to others? And it's an acknowledgement that we're all interconnected. And as we start to drill down into that, we see that everything that we do has an impact on others, that we are not an island unto ourselves. So it's also a beautiful way of coming to this understanding that we're all this one global community, which I know is being contested at this point. People are pushing back about that. But that's essentially where ahimsa is going to take you. Hi, Jay. So it's not just actions, as I mentioned. you know, we're focused on actions rather, but it's also in words. Ahimsa is practiced in words. So most of us have experienced harmful words probably more than we've experienced physical harm. And so we know that the power of words can, you know, just what that power is and how harmful words can be. So it's ahimsa, if we're going to practice ahimsa, it's about noticing when our judgment and our opinions begin to saturate into the words that come out of our mouths. And that can also sort of relate to the second of the yamas that we'll touch on probably another time, called satya, which is truth. So when we think about ahimsa, we also think about non-violent communication. How do we speak to others? And one thing that's often mentioned is, you know, is it thoughtful? Is it helpful? Is it inspiring? Is it necessary? Is it kind? I think it's supposed to spell out the word think. But those kinds of things, as we're thinking about ahimsa and our words, you know, how often do we say things or type things or spout things, especially when we're under pressure or in a time of conflict, that could be hurtful, that could bring harm to others? And why do we do that? And it's really sort of taking the observation and then moving it within and starting to unravel why. Again, we're always without judgment, just observing it and really just delving into it. So this whole, you know, idea of non-violence is also echoed in the Tao Te Ching. And there's this beautiful verse in the Tao Te Ching where he says, Lao Tzu sort of asks us that if we have to enter a battle of any kind, you know, verbally, hopefully we won't have to enter it physically, but that we do so with this like great compassion and sorrow as if attending a funeral. And this is really the way of ahimsa. It's like having this strong back but a very soft heart, and understanding that the words we put forward to others, perhaps when trying to win a point or get our point across or convince others or defend ourselves, those words we should take, you know, that moment as a realization that they're transformative, things can change, there's something that will die as we sort of enter that, and to really have compassion for the other side. And this really is like the essence of ahimsa, which is interesting at the moment because obviously some of us are, you know, feeling a little reactive and wanting to say things. So it's good to bear in mind this sort of idea of trying not to bring harm with our words. And Gandhi, who is sort of like one of the kings of ahimsa, really is considered, you know, the king of nonviolence. He said ahimsa means not to injure any creature by word, deed, or thought. So even thoughts apply when we're talking about ahimsa. So be very, very careful, yeah, and non-injury, non-harm. Being very careful about our thoughts, and that's much harder. So we're moving from like the very gross, the physical actions that we do, down into very subtle realms of our thoughts, and looking at where our thoughts cause harm. And that can be much harder because, you know, we can button our lips, but we can't hide from our thoughts. So if we're having thoughts that are judgmental, or dark in any way, or violent, or I don't know, racist and sexist, I'm trying to think of other ists, ageist, then according to the yoga philosophy, everyone feels that, it will be felt. And that, you know, the whole thing about collective consciousness, I think we can really sort of understand that at the moment, you know, as we're seeing populism like pop up around the West, you begin to get a sense that thoughts really spread very quickly. So I have to be very careful about what we're giving momentum to, and sort of just observing where we want to judge and where those parts of us pop up. And again, not judging ourselves for that, but just observing them and maybe handing them over to the higher good, or asking for some more clarity around that. In these sort of subtle realms, Deborah Adeli, who has written a book called The Yamas and Niyamas, she says that even worrying about others is a form of violence, because we're basically saying that, you know, we want to fix them, that they're not right, and as such we're taking away their power the power that they have inside themselves to help themselves. And she says instead it would be much more supporting and more like ahimsa, be more loving and in line with ahimsa, to support and encourage those around us when they need it, rather than constantly worrying about them. So you can see it can be really, really subtle as we're looking at ahimsa. But what happens as we start to delve deeper, as I mentioned, into thoughts, words and actions, is we really start to get to the bottom of why. Why are there harmful sort of thoughts, actions and deeds and words in the world? Why do we act from that place sometimes? What leads to those harmful actions, thoughts and words? What causes resentment? You know, why do I feel envious of others? Why do I not want others to succeed? And then when we really have the courage to look at why we in our collective human experience seek to cause harm, then we uncover that it's fear. Right at the bottom of it all is a fear that we won't be able to provide for ourselves, that we won't be able to provide for our families, perhaps a fear that we're not, you know, worthy, that we won't be loved, that we won't be able to survive. And back on this idea that ahimsa is very active and not passive, when you start to understand that fear is at the bottom of a lot of the harmful actions that are in the world and the thoughts and the words and the conflict that's coming out, popping up, you can't help but stand up and take compassionate action because you see the suffering that that fear is causing. And we're seeing it all over the place at the moment. Fear is manifesting in all different ways, and it's all suffering. There is nothing good that's coming out of fear right now. And so to be a warrior of ahimsa, which is really what ahimsa asks, he asks you to stand up and take action in your, you know, non-violence. To be a warrior of ahimsa, we're sort of learning that conflict is inevitable in our human experience, absolutely inevitable, but we can bring love to those conflicts and thereby change them. That love is transformative and it's redemptive. So ahimsa literally sort of means bringing out love into action, putting love into action. It's not about, you know, when we talk about is a restraint, the yamas means restraint, as I mentioned, of non-violence. It's not about sitting back and doing nothing. It's actually about putting love out there because it will transform. And so I wanted, because this is another king of ahimsa, is Martin Luther King, was just to talk or just to share with you something that he said. It was in one of his speeches, not one of his better known speeches, about the redemptive power of love and how it can overcome hate. And this was given in 1957, and there is a beautiful book, I think it's called Call to Conscience, that various people around the world, like the Dalai Lama, had chosen speeches of Martin Luther King that really spoke to them, and it's an amazing book to read his speeches. But this one isn't in it, and this one was actually recommended to me by one of my teachers, Jennifer Hadley, who recommends that you read the entire speech out loud as if it is you who's giving the sermon. And it's a very powerful thing to do, and I do recommend it. It's the Love Your Enemies speech. So I'm just going to read a little bit of this speech, and some of it, you know, will resonate, I'm sure, about what we're going through right now. So it says, love has within it a redemptive power. And there is a power there that eventually transforms individuals. That's why Jesus says, remember Martin Luther King loved Jesus, love your enemies. Because if you hate your enemies, you have no way to redeem and to transform your enemies. But if you love your enemies, you will discover that the very root of love is the power of redemption. You just keep loving people and loving them, even though they may be mistreating you. Here's the person who's your neighbor, and this person is doing something wrong to you, and all of that. Just keep being friendly. Just keep loving them. Don't do anything to shame them. Just keep loving them, and they cannot stand it too long. They react in many ways at the beginning. They react with bitterness because you're mad, because you love them. Because they're mad, sorry, because you love them. They react with guilt feelings, and sometimes they'll hate you a little more at that transition period. But just keep loving them. And by the power of your love, they will break down under the load. And that's love, you see. It's redemptive. And this is why Jesus says love. There's something about love that builds up and is creative. And there is something about hate that tears down and is destructive. So love your enemies. And then he goes on to offer this story about Abraham Lincoln. And I'm going to read this because I think this sort of points out what we would seek to be, what we should want from our leaders. I think one of the best examples, says Martin Luther King, is this. We all remember the great president of these United States, Abraham Lincoln. You remember when Abraham Lincoln was running for president of the United States, there was a man who ran all around the country talking about Lincoln. He said a lot of bad things about Lincoln and a lot of unkind things. And sometimes he would get to the point that he would even talk about his looks, saying, "You don't want a tall, lanky, ignorant man like this as the president of the United States." And he went on and on and on with that type of attitude, and then he ended up writing about it. And finally, one day, Abraham Lincoln was elected president of the United States. And if you read the great biography of Lincoln, if you read the great works about him, you will discover that as every president comes to the point, he came to this point of having to choose a cabinet. And then came the time for him to choose a Secretary of War, and he looked across the nation and decided to choose a man by the name of Mr. Stanton. And when Abraham Lincoln stood around his advisors and mentioned this fact, they said to him, "Mr. Lincoln, are you a fool? This is the man that has been saying things about you. Do you know what he's done? Do you know that he has tried to defeat you on every hand? Do you know? Did you read all those derogatory statements he made about you?" And Abraham Lincoln stood before the advisors around him and said, "Yes, I know. I read about it. But after looking over the country, I find he is the best man for the job." So Mr. Stanton did become Secretary of War. And a few months later, Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. And if you go to Washington, you will discover that one of the greatest words and statements ever made about Abraham Lincoln was made by Mr. Stanton. And as Abraham Lincoln came to the end of his life, Stanton stood up and said, "Now he belongs to the ages." And he made a beautiful statement about the character and stature of this man. And if Abraham Lincoln had hated Stanton, if Abraham Lincoln had answered everything Stanton said, Abraham Lincoln would not have transformed and redeemed Stanton, and Stanton would have gone to his grave hating Lincoln, and Lincoln would have gone to his grave hating Stanton. But through the power of love, Abraham Lincoln was able to redeem Stanton. And I think this is just such a beautiful story and part of his speech about the redemptive power of love. And it's helpful, I think, to look at people who do display ahimsa, who are living a life of ahimsa or have lived a life of ahimsa. So obviously Martin Luther King, and he was inspired a lot by Gandhi, talks about Gandhi a lot. And if you think about Desmond Tutu and some of the things, you know, the non-violence that he led to help bring down apartheid. And it's not just the spiritual leaders, you know, you could say the Pope and the Dalai Lama in their way are warriors of ahimsa right now, as are sort of our local spiritual leaders. But it's also, you know, like poets and writers. So I was thinking this morning of Toni Morrison and all that she's written in her novels that has really brought to life in a very raw way the pains of racism. And there's a British Somali poet called Warsan Shire. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but her poetry has really, you know, brought, again, sort of shed light on the pains of refugees, of the refugee crisis. You know, one of the lines that is often quoted by this very young, at the time, unknown poet was, "No one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land." And then we have George Monbiot. I don't know if you're aware of him, but he writes a lot about the environment in a very, very beautiful way that helps you really connect with the world and some of the challenges that we're seeing in terms of conservation. So poets and writers, you know, you don't have to be great spiritual leaders, but it's not about sort of being well known or even, you know, a celebrity status. You know, it's the teacher that stands up for students in a school system that is perhaps unsupportive. That would be an example of ahimsa, this love in action, this sort of power of bringing love forward in a redemptive way. A person who writes a letter to a congressman, perhaps, and says, you know, I support you in your actions, or I'm unhappy about this and would like change. It's the peaceful demonstrator, the peaceful marcher. It's the person who, you know, sits down to pray with another of a different religion. It's the person on the subway who smiles at someone who might be feeling alone or isolated. It's someone who stands up for others. So it's a really, it's very, you know, we can look to people like Martin Luther King and Gandhi as this inspiration, but it should never feel out of reach that we can live this life of ahimsa, this very sort of peaceful way of not just sitting idly back, but making our stand in the world. And whether that stand is to pray, or whether it's to march, or whether it's to just stand up, whatever we do it with this sort of, as a wall of love, as Carrie Christensen told me this week, becoming a wall of love. Okay, sorry, I'm just going to have a sip of water. And then I wanted to just talk about in sort of this, you know, non-violent, what can we do? This is part of the same speech by Martin Luther King, and I just read it this morning and I thought, goodness, it's like he's talking now and not almost 60 years ago. And it says this, and I've I'm shortening this a bit for time, but I'm hoping that the tone is still kept. Oh, this morning, as I think of the fact that our world is in transition now, our whole world is facing a revolution. Our nation is facing a revolution, our nation. And there are three ways that individuals who are oppressed can deal with their oppression. One of them is to rise up against their oppressors with physical violence and corroding hatred. But oh, this isn't the way. For the danger and the weakness of this method is its futility. Violence creates many more social problems than it solves. Another way is to acquiesce and to give in, to resign yourself to the oppression. Some people do that. But that too isn't the way, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. But there is another way, and that is to organize mass nonviolent resistance based on the principle of love. It seems to me that this is the only way, as our eyes look to the future, as we look out across the years and across the generations, let us develop and move right here. We must discover the power of love, the power, the redemptive power of love. And when we discover that, we will be able to make of this old world a new world. We will be able to make men better. Love is the only way. So I just thought that really kind of sums up, you know, as maybe as a spiritual person, you're a spiritual seeker, you're sat thinking about, you know, how do you, what is your role there? I just sort of love this idea of this, you know, this non-violent resistance. And non-violent resistance can mean just not getting engaged in it. It can mean that. It can mean not adding, you know, pouring kerosene on the flames. As I mentioned earlier, you know, for each of us, the best thing we can ever do is just go inside and see what is the role we can play. And maybe it'll be surprising to us. So one of the things that I wanted to be clear about when we're talking about ahimsa is that it's not asking us to be perfect. There's plenty of things you can read about Martin Luther King and Gandhi and Desmond Tutu that will will mention parts of their lives that, you know, maybe they weren't always living in this ahimsa, or certainly anyway, moving on. But it isn't asking us to be perfect people. And also, you know, we cannot do everything. I don't know about you, but, you know, sometimes I can get myself in a bit of a mire because I think, okay, right, I've just bought a coat that doesn't have goose down. I'm very proud of this fact that I'm not sort of taking part in the harming of geese with my winter coat. And then I read an article and it said, well, if you happen to have bought this type of fabric, then that fabric comes off in the wash and is killing the oceans. And I thought, oh my God, I'm now going to have to go through my whole wardrobe and make sure I don't have any of this stuff, but I've already bought it. And we can sort of get really sort of tied up in causes, especially, you know, with social media. You can think, oh my God, there's something going on now in the rainforest, and there's the palm oil, and then there's oppression. And you kind of have to, you know, wade through it all. And we're not supposed to be these perfect individuals. We're not supposed to answer everything. You know, people are complex. And we see this in the Bhagavad Gita. Drihi remember is this blind king, and we're about to have this battle. If you remember, Arjuna is going to start this battle with all his cousins, and he says, you know, at the beginning, I love these people. There is bad, but there's also good. And Dhritarashtra is sort of seen as the king that they're fighting against, but Dhritarashtra has a lot of love for Arjuna and his brothers, and he doesn't want the war to happen. So as we know about individuals, you know, things are very complex, and we're not, as I say, aiming for perfection and to practice ahimsa every moment. Ahimsa and having it there as a tool for us to look at is really just to remind us to move with like love in action. And there's this lovely quote by Gandhi, if I can try and find it. Maybe it's Martin Luther King. So this is it. It says, seeing the good in all. Within the best of us, he says, there is some evil. And within the worst of us, there is some good. And it's helpful to remember that and discover the element of good in your enemy. And as you seek to hate him, find the center of goodness and place your attention there, and you will take a new attitude. And he also points out that, you know, it's not about individuals. He says, when you rise to the level of love of its great beauty and power, you seek only to defeat systems. Individuals who are caught up in that system, you love and love and love and love. And then he also mentions that you don't have to like them. You know, we're not asking, you know, Ahimsa doesn't ask you to just sort of let go of you know, your values. You've got to be authentic to yourself. You need to be who you are, but it's a practice of I'm not agreeing with you, I'm in conflict with you or your opinions right now, but I can still be loving towards you. I can still create a space that is redemptive and opening and powerful rather than closing, because, you know, hate closes us down. Okay, so yeah, very much this sort of love in action. And in the book Meditations on the Mats by Rolf Gates and Katrina Kennison, and they talk quite a lot about the yamas and niyamas. It's a modern book. They say this, which I thought was really beautiful. The yamas and niyamas would not be needed if we, the entire human race, did not already have the propensity to violate them. But paradoxically, the yamas and niyamas would not be possible to uphold if our true essence were not love, if love were not our aim and our home. So while we think, well, God, you know, how can we practice ahimsa? Really what they're saying is, you know, ahimsa is who you are. So it's not this far off reach. It's not something that you're never going to get. It is who you are. And they go on to say, to practice the yamas, we must find the maturity to tolerate the duality of our nature while allowing the possibility of victory over our darkness. I love this. We must find the maturity to tolerate the duality of our nature, because that's what we have. It's a duality, as politics shows us, while allowing the possibility of victory over our darkness. Love is not a thought. It is an action. Although I would argue love is also a thought. And each loving action we take infuses us with more energy for loving action in the future. So every time we practice, and rather not just think about yamas and niyamas, not just thinking about ahimsa, every time we practice, we are putting love into action. And then Gandhi sort of offered this too. He said that ahimsa is actually the attribute of the soul. that means that ahimsa is our very, very nature. And it goes beyond all its translations, he says, of non-violence and non-harm. He says it really is quite simply love. That's it. It's just this one word, love. I thought it would be helpful to sort of discuss ahimsa in light of, you know, what we're going through in some of the yamas. And the next one is satya, which is truth and about being authentic, but ultimately just really guarding our words and what we're saying. But I don't want to sort of start that this week. I'd rather just focus on ahimsa, if that's okay. So I don't know if there are any questions from the room. Just take a bit of a pause and see if anyone's got any questions about ahimsa. If anyone's got any suggestions of other people, iconic people or examples of ahimsa in our life. No. Okay. So we're a little early, but there was a song I wanted to play, and there's also a prayer that I wanted to sort of for us to have together as a group this evening. And it's actually a prayer that my mum gave me today. And my mum does not subscribe to prayer. So even that, in the light of all this conflict and apparent hatred and upset that's happening, I sort of feel that there's even been a transformation there. Oh, Jay has a question. So before we go on with this prayer, I'm just going to give the mic to Jay. Okay, Jay, one of the problems I have when I drop the mic is that I then have to leave the room and come back and pick up the mic again. So just so you know, if I'm gone, I'm coming straight back. Okay, and we'll see how this goes.
Yeah, the question I have, Helen, is how do you see all about, focusing on the good nature, everyone that has evil nature has good within them, everyone good that has evil, like the yin-yang principle. How do you see that equating to non-duality teachings in your thinking? That's the question. Is she back yet? So she okay. So I asked the question, you left the room. Okay. I'll repeat the question. The question is that you made a lot of comments about like sort of yin yang nature, such as, you know, you can find good, a little bit of good within every evil. You can find evil within every good. Focus on the good. How do you see, and in your thinking and in your understanding currently, the duality, good and evil principle relating to non-duality? How do you see that as fitting into those teachings? Just giving up the mic.
Okay. There we go. That seems to work. Sorry about that. So let me just see if I've understood this correctly. You're saying as we look at the world in its duality, how we perceive, how does that fit into the context of non-duality? I don't know if you can just give me a yes or no in the room. Let me know if I've understood that right, Jay. Okay. It's true, and I was going to mention this at the beginning. It's like, I think for as long as we feel like we're living in a world of duality and we haven't reached a point of living in a world of non-duality or reaching that level of understanding, then we just kind of work with what we've got. Now, if you look at it from a level of non-duality, then, you know, we're all one and there is no good and there is no evil. There is just differences, and differences should be celebrated, which I agree with. However, in the world that we live in, some things lead us towards hate and suffering, and some lead us away from suffering. So that's kind of how I think about it. I think about, as we are acting in the world, can we reduce suffering? And do those things to reduce suffering. And until I reach the point personally where I understand that the world is one, that's probably what I'm going to keep doing. And from what I gather from those who, and as Ron says, you know, it's not possible to be non-dual in this world. From what I gather from those who have reached a point where they understand a non-duality, that they have achieved like oneness, samadhi, that, you know, if you want to be a bodhisattva, you come back and you play in the world of duality, and you play towards ending suffering. And by, you know, acting to end suffering, you're essentially admitting that there is like a suffering to be had. And so helping others move through that is really a goal. You know, for example, and I talked about this before, sometimes, you know, if you walk past a homeless person and they put their hand out, and you think, oh well, it's their karma and we're all one and they're actually fine, then that's not being compassionate. So sorry, in your own imperfect path of undoing, what is your current experience, if you care to share? Can you just clarify that? What do you mean, in my own imperfect path of undoing, what is your current experience? My current experience of what? With non-duality, what is my current experience of non-duality? I guess it's just what I said, is that it's seeing suffering is painful, and I think that's, you know, you're not human if you don't see suffering and want to change it in some way. And it's just a question of going within and seeing, you know, what are the reasons I'm changing it for? And really, I mean, the best answer I could give is that I personally just try always to go within and ask for guidance of what I should do and when I should act and when you leave it alone and when you don't leave it alone. And it's, I don't always hear that guidance. You know, at the moment I'm drawn to get on the phone and make some calls to stop what I perceive could be hatred spreading, but I'm not sort of drawn yet to get out and go marching. I'm drawn to pray. There are many things I'm sort of feel like I'm drawn towards, and I'm trying not to get into this idea of I'm right and someone else is wrong, and trying to sort of understand that you know, there are the teachings, and I have faith in these teachings that we are, you know, all one. But I, as I say, I feel very strongly that if you want to develop compassion, then you have to ease suffering for others and think about the suffering of others and think about how you can be of service to the world. Especially, I mean, if you think we're all one and we're all interconnected, then why wouldn't you want to be of service to the world? You know, because you're being of service to yourself. So there's that. I don't know if that's helpful at all, or if it's just confusing. You know, sometimes I am confused as to what to do, but I come back to this idea of just always asking within, and I honestly, and I mean this sincerely, like the yamas and niyamas are so important to me. You know, if you cut me open, I'd bleed yamas and niyamas. I write about them all the time. I talk about them all the time. And in my path of yoga, it is the yamas and niyamas. I mean, I just, the most important part, the rest I kind of almost let go, just because there's such comfort and guidance in these times, always just to act with love. That's not always hard. I mean, that's not that's not always easy. Okay. So I don't know if that's helpful, Jay, but that's how I'm feeling at the minute. I hope I get to hear how it's going for you, but I'm sort of nervous to leave the room and come back and drop the mic because we're having some technical glitches. So I just wanted to end, you know, as I mentioned, my mum shared this prayer with me today, and it's one that I'm sure we're all familiar with, but it was just really poignant for me because, as I say, my mum does not subscribe to prayer at all. But it was a serenity prayer, and so I thought that was very beautiful and tied into a hymn, sir. So I wonder if we can just sort of end today with this prayer. So just closing the eyes and relaxing and sort of tuning into our heart, that place where we can understand that we're all interconnected, that we are all one. So God, or whatever your word for God may be, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, and courage to change the things that I can, and grant me the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. And I guess, Jay, that's kind of the prayer that answers it, you know, just to keep asking that prayer, praying that prayer. Amen. Thank you. So I've got a few minutes, and I wanted to play for you a version of Hallelujah, which in light of Leonard Cohen leaving us, transitioning on, that's by Jay Jagdish, and she sings mantras so beautifully, but she actually does a version of the song with the third verse, which is about serving others. I don't think we're going to get there in 3 minutes, sadly. Or maybe I'll start from the middle of the song for the couple of minutes, and then I'll give up the mic and thank you, Kelly. Thanks. I don't want to eat into your time, but I appreciate it. Okay. Here we go. So I'm just going to try and fade in a little bit.
Strong, but you needed proof. Saw her dancing on the roof, her beauty in the moonlight. Oh, that's real, yeah. She tied you to her kitchen chair. She broke your throne. She cut your hair, and from you.